So, okay. About a month ago, I got to go to Saudi Arabia. So they opened up for tourism about 5 years ago. And so the odd place to go for tourism, right, to go to the middle of the desert, looks like it's kind of a combination of the South Dakota Badlands and the moon. It's kind of like how the Saudi Arabian desert is. So, so it's amazing what all that happened there. Question, like, why would I want to go to Saudi Arabia for vacation? And Sarah was very gracious to let me leave for a while. Anyway, but it's because, you know, I believe that's where the Exodus happened. And so the Exodus is this grand story, right? So my presentation is titled Real Past, Real Future. And have you ever wondered, like, if something is real or not? Like, if you fly a plane out of Tel Aviv, probably, or Ben Gurion Airport, and you meet a Jew, there's a very high chance, and you meet a Christian in a college in America, there's a very high chance you're going to find somewhere that says the story of Exodus was just a story. It's a myth. It's something made up, right? Even, like, most modern Jews in Tel Aviv would probably say something like this, right? Like, it's just a story, right? And we know that there's all sorts of things that are said about the Bible. Like, the Bible is just a story. The book of Revelation, like, you know, that's just, is Jesus really going to come on the sky? Is some guy really going to come riding a horse or a chariot and, like, fly through the sky and fix the world, right? And so, like, did someone actually walk through an ocean, you know, on dry ground? Like, and these are the stories that Israel repeated to themselves over and over and over again. So, kind of answering the question there, why does it matter? Why would one want to go visit Mount Sinai? So this is a picture of Mount Sinai, but it's an old mountain and a very old story. And a lot of people say it's just a myth, right? What does it have to do with us? But so I went there because I believe it's an old story, but also it's a story that's going to repeat itself. The Bible has motifs, right? Models. And so there's a big model in the Bible about the Sinai as being repeated. Sinai was the covenant, the marriage betrothal, kind of like Mary and Joseph, you know, they got betrothed, but they weren't really married. And so that betrothal was a big thing in Jewish times. And then the marriage happened later. Mount Sinai was a betrothal, though. There's lots of things that happened there that was very much like a marriage covenant, like the Ten Commandments. But then, like, we talk about the marriage supper of God, that we're all invited to go have supper with God, and the church is called the Bride of Christ. So it's repeated over and over again. So I think it's something in the past, something in the future. Feel free to interrupt me or ask any questions. Like, we're a small group, so. So the story of Moses is very important, even to the early Christians. So, like, when Stephen was seized by the legislature of Israel at the time, he said, "We have heard them say that Jesus of Nazareth will destroy this place and change the customs Moses handed down to us." So the new teaching of Jesus was very concerning, and they were concerned they would change the story of Moses. Like, Moses was the bedrock of everything. And Moses was all about God coming down to man, right? So, like, God came down to man and he revealed himself. He saved everybody in Egypt. He saved man, saved them from Egypt, saved them from slavery, and he changes the earth, right? That's what we want, especially as, like, you know, part of this church, that God always intercepts our life. He comes and does something in our lives. So the story of the Exodus was prevalent in the New Testament as well. And, that's the wrong direction. Okay, so I believe the Mount Sinai is a real place, a real archaeology, geography, history, and social evidence. So if you have your Bible, I don't have all the scriptures on the screen. I'm just going to go through them quickly. But kind of start in Exodus 17. So Exodus is the story, right, of, you know, the people of Israel. And so they come across the Red Sea. That's important. And so this is the geography. So here's Egypt, right? here's the Red Sea. Both of these things are called the Red Sea, but this part right here is called the Red Sea multiple times in the Old Testament. So they came out of Egypt, and they're kind of trying to go to Israel, right? So we flew into this town right here, Tabuk. Ready, go. Okay, so I'm going to go back and forth. So I'm just kind of zooming in. I'm going to zoom in on this section right here. If I put, draw a square right there. And so this is that Red Sea I talked about right here. And so if you ever there's a movie called The Patterns of Evidence. So I'm going to go over a lot of assumptions and a lot of things. But there's a movie called The Patterns of Evidence, a whole 9-part documentary made out of a guy from Minneapolis named Tim Mahoney. I've got copies of it I can bring even to community needs if you want to. Look at the Red Sea crossing or the Mount Sinai. So I'm going to assume a lot of things that like intellectual scholars will sometimes debate. But a lot of times it's debated because they think it's not real. Like Jesus, like the guy couldn't really split the ocean and walk across it. But if it did happen, like there'd be evidence of it, right? And so we see there's evidence already in Egypt. So they come across Mount Sinai, and there's a huge beachhead that fits the description of Josephus. And then there's a place to cross the Red Sea. If you go under the ocean, it's very gentle, up and down. Like old people, young kids could walk across there, even with carts, if it was dry. And then they come up into the mountains. So here is Mount St. Catherine's, which is the traditional Mount Sinai. So I had people from work ask, you know, going to Egypt, going to Mount Sinai, Mount Sinai, going to Egypt. Like, no, not going to Egypt. And then you have this right here, Jebel Allah's in Saudi Arabia. So it's a story. It's an incredible story. But a lot of people that say, like, well, the Moses story is obviously false because we go to some Mount St. Catherine's, which has been considered Mount Sinai for 1,600 years, right here, number one. There is zero evidence anybody ever lived there, right? So, like, if you look at the numbers in Exodus, there's probably about 3 million people that came out of Exodus. People say it's either 6,000 to 3 million, but it's a lot of people anywhere. And even if a lot of people live in the desert, imagine going to the Badlands and, like, leaving your wrapper, right? It's going to stay there for a long time. Or going to the moon, like, they left things on the moon that's still there. And that's how these deserts are. They preserve everything. So there'd be evidence of people living at Mount St. Catherine's Monastery or the mountain if there really were people who lived there for a year and they had all these amazing things happen to them. Like, you know, God came on the mountain. They built a tabernacle. There's a lot of iron work and all that stuff that had to happen for that. But there's zero evidence at all that anybody ever was here. There's no archaeology. There's no writings. There's no markings. There's no evidence of tent circles, Neolithic structures. And the structure, the shape of the mountain actually doesn't work from Exodus 24 either. So this has been a detriment to Judaism and Christianity because people are like, there's no evidence that ever existed. Like, Constantine shows this mountain, like in 400, 300, and everybody's like, okay. Like, Constantine was in charge of the whole world, so they just said yes. And so, but it's on the wrong side of the Red Sea, right? So, like, if they came down there, they didn't have to cross any water to get there. So why would they have to cross the water? Like, it doesn't make any sense. Like, why would you purposely run down? If you're going to land of Midian here, that's also the thing. Land of Midian was where Jethro was from. Moses' wife and his father-in-law were from here. So if he's going here, he wouldn't have to go across the water. Anyway, so I'm trying to keep on moving because I'll just show you some of the pictures. But if you go to, you'd think that if you go to the Mount Sinai, you'd find like evidence of 3 million people living in the desert. They must have left a pot. They must have broken a pot. They must have put a tent up or had a tent peg. And when they built altars, they built them out of rocks. And so they think maybe they find something that existed there. But there's nothing in Egypt. But if you keep on, there's Mount St. Catherine's, there's Mount Jebel Allah's in Saudi Arabia. This is a proposed route, right, the Nuweiba beach crossing to Mount Sinai. So, but if you go to Saudi Arabia, all of a sudden, there's all sorts of things sitting in the desert. It's just really amazing. And so This is a Google Earth image. It's really hard to see on this screen, but there's stories in Exodus. You can follow Exodus. So you start in right. You start in chapter 15, 14 and 15. They cross the Red Sea. So you can find a Red Sea crossing that fits the geography, and the beachhead there is totally surrounded by mountains. So if they went down to that water, they would have been surrounded. There's nowhere to go when the Egyptians came after them. There's no way to get out. It was a valley. It came to a beachhead, and like the only choice was to go across the ocean, which makes sense, right? Otherwise, like, why would you try to go across an ocean, right? I mean, you just run somewhere else. But the beachhead here, and it says there in Exodus that God told them to divert because he wanted to show off, right? So like a guy would show off to his girlfriend when they're trying to get engaged, right? So that's that motif. And then you can go to Exodus 17, and there's a big rock that gets split. And later on, the Bible is called the Rock of Horeb. You go there, and like I mentioned, the whole landscape is somewhere between the Badlands and the moon. You're like, the Rock of Horeb? Like, there's rocks everywhere. You can't even walk without just looking at your ground all the time, because you're going to twist your ankle or your knee, because it's just like you're walking on the moon. You twist your ankle, there's so many rocks. Like, it was called the Rock of Horeb. That's kind of a weird name for a place that's full of rocks. Then you have a battle with the Amalekites, some desert living people. Jethro visits. Jethro, there's a huge well. They come across Elam, which had, in Numbers, they come across Elam, which has had 12 wells and 70 palm trees. They come across a big oasis. So there's a story, right? And then they eventually reach Mount Sinai. When they reach Mount Sinai, they're told they can't touch the mountain. If you touch the mountain, it's too holy. So if someone touches the mountain, they'll be killed. They'll be killed with a bow and arrow, or you throw rocks at them, you stone them. They couldn't even touch the person who touched the mountain. That's how holy the mountain was. So that was the rule. And then the Ten Commandments. And then in Exodus 24, we're kind of rolling through Exodus real fast. In Exodus 24, you have Moses sacrifices a whole bunch of animals and makes the people holy. He puts blood on the people. Some people say he may put blood on like pillars to represent the people, versus like putting blood on 3 million people's foreheads is kind of weird. But maybe he did it. But certainly the leaders of Israel were there to represent Israel and did all the sacrifices in Exodus 24. And then I mentioned in Exodus 19, they said, you can't touch the mountain, you'll die. And then in Exodus 24, they all go up on the mountain and they eat with God, but they don't die. And then it also says in Exodus 24, they go on the mountain, and only Moses can go on the mountain, and he doesn't, otherwise you die. It's very, you read this, and you read it like, just sitting in your bedroom, and you're like, that's super confusing. Like, you go on the mountain, you don't go on the mountain, you die, you don't die. And it's like, how does this work? Like, it's like God is confused. Then you go on to Exodus 32, and Moses is up on the mountain, they build a golden calf, right? Because in Egypt, they worshipped cows. So in Egypt, they worshipped cows, and so they went back to what they knew. They're like, oh, there must be the Egypt cow god that got us across the ocean, so we'll just make the Egypt cow god, we'll worship him, because we don't help this Moses guy. After everything happened, all 10 commandments, all 10 plagues, going across the ocean, having manna come down, having the water come out of the rock, they still just went back to what they knew. So all this stuff you'd expect to see, be able to find some of this stuff. It's all in the desert, and nothing changes in the very quickly in the desert, right? Like you find, in Arizona you can find the cave dwellings of the Aztecs or the help me out. The Pueblos, thank you. And you can find, the pyramids in Egypt. You can find all this stuff in the desert. It doesn't go away. But, like, so you expect to find all this stuff. And you can see from this map, you can find every single thing. So I'm going to go through this quickly. But, like, kind of the point is, like, the whole story is real, right? So these are actually all the markings you can, all the places you can find. Okay, the split rock. So it says the Rock of Horeb in Exodus 17, like I mentioned, God says to strike the rock and water will come out, enough water for 3 million people. It wasn't like a trickle, it wasn't a water fountain. It was enough water for 3 million people to actually they could clean their clothes as well. So you need to find a big rock, and there happens to be a really, really big rock with a huge split in it, just on the other side of the mountain range. So this rock is six stories tall, just the rock. This portion is six stories tall on top of a big hill. So it's kind of hard to tell the sizing of it. You can go online. I really encourage you, if you're interested in this, you go on YouTube. I'll put the references in the last slide as references. The movies and the books. There's a book called Sinai Design, which I'll get into the theology part at the end here. But so there's a big rock. So it's behind me right there. It's obviously smaller, not smaller than my head. But so there's a picture, and there's a video online you can find on Vimeo of a guy who did a lot of drone shots. And the drone pans out, and so he's standing right here. So the size of that arrow, not even the head of the arrow, but the body of the arrow is about the height of a man. So it's a big rock. And it's on a hill in the middle of a valley that's surrounded. It's the only hill in the middle of the valley. And so they call it the Rock of Horeb. And Horeb is the mountain range area. And so it kind of makes sense, right? You find a big rock that's split, and you can see erosion patterns. Granted, there's erosion patterns throughout the entire desert. It looks like the moon and the badlands, like there's wind erosion too, but there's definitely erosion patterns coming out of the bottom of this rock. Okay, so that's Exodus 17, right? And there's a battle there with the Amalekites. You might find some evidence of that if this actually happened. Okay, so they fought the Amalekites. So I mentioned in Exodus 19, they said that they couldn't go on the mountain. So you go on the backside of Mount Sinai. It's hard to show you on the video, on the drawing, but it's like on the, let's say, the east side of Mount Sinai. You go to a rock enclave, and this is an overhang. And where the overhang is, where they haven't worn from the, there is yearly rain there. But you can find drawings of archers, similar to what it says you had to be shot with an arrow. And this, interesting of the drawings of these archers, is that there's no animals. So there's normally in like this cave drawings, you'd find animals, you know, because they're killing something. That's what they're doing with their arrows. But in this instance, there's no arrows. And Exodus 17 says to put people around and actually put signs up. I don't know. It looks like an ancient sign. The Battle of the Amalekites in 17, there's a cave drawing of some really big people fighting some really small people. And throughout the story of the Exodus, we're told that the Israelites thought the other people were giants. Like, that's one reason, you know, that's the reason that Joshua and Caleb got denied going into the Promised Land, because all the rest of the guys said, they're too big for us. They're giants. And the Amalekites were called giants, too. So it's interesting. It's like, this is just on the bottom of the mountain. You just happen to find drawings of people with bow and arrows with no animals. And you had people, giant people fighting small people in a cave drawing. Coincidence. So then Exodus 24, Moses sacrifices a whole bunch of animals and puts blood on all the people, right? So this is standing in front of Mount Sinai, but you see this chevron-shaped thing, and right here is an altar. The Saudi archaeologists excavated this. They found ashes, they found organic material, and they found bones. No pigs. Only bones of sheep and goats. So there are no pigs sacrificed here or burned here. The chevron shape is interesting. There's the next slide, we'll show that. So there are some modern kill floors, like we're a meatpacking city, right? There's some modern kill floors that are shaped like a chevron, because the animals are smart enough to see when other animals are getting killed, they're going to turn around. And so in this case, they believe this chevron shape was where the animals were lined up to be killed. They had to sacrifice a lot of animals to put blood on everybody. And they had 12 different tribes. They had 12 different people had to sacrifice, right, the leaders of each of the tribes, or 70 leaders. So you have this altar. You have some rooms in the altar. If you go online, you can find that it's very similar to some other altars in Jewish history, Semitic peoples. And so the altar even the same size as the altar in Jerusalem. And it was built, it was very important in Israeli and Semitic times, or according to the Israelites, that they didn't do any dressed stone. They didn't put any flint or rock. They only used regular rocks. It was also very Neolithic, as far as like, you know, caveman type thing to kind of do. But this
this fits very much a Neolithic structure, and there's no just regular rocks just piled on top of each other. Okay, so that's kind of cool. You run into Exodus 19 there, Exodus 24. So then Exodus 32, right? Then Moses goes on the mountain that should be, that says in some places was scorched by fire. The top of the mountain happens to be black. And you go, like I mentioned, it's kind of hard to describe here, but I'm going to go way, way back here. Oh, wrong direction. Okay, so this is Mount Sinai. Okay, so here's the blackened peak. It's actually black. It's like an alpine tree line. It's a very distinct line, like if you're in Colorado, all of a sudden you have trees, no trees. All of a sudden you have red rock, then you have black rock. And so you'd expect to have I lost my train of thought, but one part of the mountain in Exodus 24 is that they go up on the mountain, like I mentioned, and then but they don't go on the mountain. Only Moses go on the mountain. They're on the mountain. They see God, but they don't die. But they nobody could touch the mountain. They die. It's very confusing. And so even before the Saudi Arabia became popular, some theologians would say the mountain had to have two peaks because you had to be able to go on the mountain, but you weren't really on the mountain. And so, weirdly, this mountain has four peaks. But so there's the first peak right here, and then the second peak. And right beyond this first peak is a very flat plain of sand where you could have dinner with 70 people, which normally on a mountain you can't do. It's a very rugged mountain. It's not like there's no trail or anything. It's there's no flat spots on the mountain except for right here. There's a huge flat spot where if the Lord was sitting on the top here, they could see his bronze feet when he was on his throne. And this makes sense then. Exodus 24 suddenly makes sense when you see the geography of real life. Nobody could touch the mountain except for the elders. They went on the mountain up here, but they didn't actually go on the top, on the second peak that's blackened. And Moses went up there, but they didn't. And so it makes sense they were on the mountain, but they weren't on the mountain. And they can go on, but they would die, and they wouldn't. So they call this the Plateau of the Elders. And that's what I was going to say. Like, from the base of this peak, it's like the moon. So this is actually quite a ways from the mountain. You can see, starting with grass, or sand, all beyond here is total rock. Like, you can never put a tent. It's like, you know, you're trying to go camping and try to find a flat spot with no sticks and no rocks. So there's nowhere to camp anywhere close, probably a half an hour, 45-minute walk. And so way far away here is where you find a whole bunch of sand where maybe 3 million people can camp. And it's a huge sandy spot, like miles, many square miles. But you'd kind of have to be, if you had kids and your grandma, you wouldn't be trying to camp on all the rocks where you can't even walk or twist your ankle. So right at the edge where the sandy spot hits, you find something interesting. Where the people would be hanging out when Moses is on top of the mountain, you find Exodus 32. So I mentioned they used to worship cows in Egypt, right? So all of a sudden you find this big pile of boulders, kind of like in Colorado you can find boulders, Garden of the Gods has big boulders, right? You find a big pile of boulders, two of them. One pile of boulders, not the other one, is covered in cow drawings and covered in animal drawings and cow drawings and people drawings. And you can, I don't know any Hebrew, but they say there's some Hebrew letters on here, and there's a whole bunch of cow drawings. You see, this is one of the bigger ones. This guy is Joel Richardson. He wrote the book Sinai and Zion. He led the tour, which if you want, I can reference that book later. But so this is a picture of an actual Egyptian worship picture, hieroglyph in Egypt, like in Ramses or something. And you can see there's interesting things about what they do with the cows. So they stand under the cows, and they hold the cow up from the bottom, which I wouldn't do that if I was, you know, ordering a cow. But anyway, and then they hold the cow's tail. Sorry, wrong one. They hold the cow's tail. And it's, I guess there's some worship reason they hold the cow's tail, right? So there's in Egypt, right? This is like, you know, people have found this. This image is from the internet, and they drew it out. So what do you find on these drawings? Well, you find a cow with a dude holding his tail. You find a cow with a dude holding it up from the bottom. Where'd they get that idea from? Maybe they're from Egypt. Anyway. So, and these are Neolithic drawings that have been proven to be old by smart people. Okay, so there's a lot of drawings. Like, there's another drawing of I got a drawing, my picture of myself with this one. He's holding his tail again. And it surrounds this pile of rocks, 360. Even underneath on the bottom side, they have paintings with, like, dye that hasn't washed off in the rain because it's on the bottom. These ones are carved in the dark spots. But, like, there are pictures of cows and other drawings in Saudi Arabia. But, like, this rock is right on the edge of the sandy where you'd be camping. You wouldn't be camping on the rocks with 3 million people, and it's right there. And there's flat spots up there, and it's higher where you can see it. Interestingly, it says when Moses came down the mountain, he heard the clamor, and then he saw it. You can see this pile of rocks from the very top of the mountain. You can see it all the way down. We had the clouds of the smoke of God around you, you wouldn't be able to see it. But once you got down low enough, you'd be able to see this from anywhere on the mountain. Okay, so you happen to have, when you go to this place in Mount Saudi Arabia, you happen to have things that match exactly Elim, which is the 70 wells, the 70 palm trees and the 12 wells in Numbers. You happen to have a Red Sea crossing that works perfectly. You happen to have a huge rock, a six-story rock on top of a big hill that has a huge crack in all the sides in the middle of it, like it says in the Psalms. You just happen to have drawings of big people fighting little people. You happen to have pictures of archers in the bottom of the mountain that is said to be the real mountain, and that's the method of death that Moses declared for anybody who touched the mountain in Exodus 19. You happen to have a mountain that fits really well with Exodus 24. The super confusing. You're on the mountain. You're not on the mountain. You're dead. You're not dead. Like, where are you? Like, you know, where's Waldo? Where are the 70 elders of Israel? You happen to have a mountain whose geography fits that perfectly. And there's a flat spot with sand. God even made it nice for them, right? They had to eat dinner on the rocks. He made it a sandy spot. That happens in the Second Kings. Elijah runs to Horeb on, like, miraculously with the angel's help and some bread. He fasts for 40 days and nights and runs to Horeb. So something miraculous happened, right? He goes to a cave. You happen to have a big cave that you can live in. I can show that on the last photo. It's just weird how it all happens to be there at the same spot. Okay, so this is the picture. I mentioned the sandy area. So this is the sandy area. This is the fence the Saudis put up because they realize it's important. The Bedouins don't like the Saudis, so they run over the fences and open them up. But this is a second pile of rock that has really no drawings on it. This, all around this whole pile of rocks, you have all these drawings. The cow with the guy holding the tail is right on the edge of this rock right here. And there's one other big drawing here. And then all the way from here is the base of the mountain. Here's Mount Sinai. Here's the second peak. The cave is right about there. Here's Moses' altar. And all the way here you have rocks at drawings as well that happen to be party drawings, like ancient party drawings. Think of orgies. They're kind of detailed. You can tell it's an orgy on the way here. Which in Exodus 24 it says they worshipped and they got off to play. They sat down to eat and they got off to play. Play has, they weren't playing Legos. Okay, so after they don't play Legos and they they worship the Egyptian cow deity, then Moses comes down, right, and he throws the rocks. He throws the tablets. They break, which is a symbol of breaking the covenant, breaking the marriage betrothal that we just made, right? He's like, you broke the marriage betrothal during the betrothal ceremony. It's like, it's like cheating on your spouse, like on your wedding night. So they build this golden calf, and so Moses comes down, and he's like, who's with me? Who's really for the Lord? And the Levites come to him. Levites happen to be the smallest tribe. And he's like, go take out the people who are doing this. Like, they're worshiping Egypt. God just brought them out through the Red Sea. He just brought them out, and he took out the world's most powerful army in the world. He just took out the world's most powerful army for you, and with all this stuff, and you just worship the cow instead. And so they killed 3,000 people, and you wouldn't bury them in your camp. So interestingly, a mile or two away, you find this huge Neolithic cemetery. So these are standing stones, which is typical of a very ancient cemetery. We still do standing stones today, right, in our cemeteries. And there's a whole field of them. And then there's mass burial graves with a whole bunch of rocks piled up. Maybe they're all related. Sadly, this area is fenced off by the Saudis, but sadly some people are knocking these stones over now. But now that's becoming more popular because people are just do things that are stupid. But there's whole rows of them. You kind of like see a row of standing stones. So that's odd. Like, you'd kill 3,000 people in the desert, you have to put them somewhere. And there happens to be a big, very, very ancient cemetery right around the corner. Okay, so there's more, but there's too much to kind of go through, and we only have 15 minutes left. So, but kind of the point is, like, it's real, right? So, like, all this stuff, like, you'd expect to see all this stuff. Mount St. Catharines has none of it. They have what they say is the burning bush that survived 3,000 years somehow. But anyway, just kind of, they say, like, weird stuff, right? Like, there's an actual burning bush. Like, really? And, but you expect to find real archaeology. You expect the geography of the mountain to be able to explain, like, the weirdness of Exodus 24, like, you're on the mountain, but you're not a mountain. You'd expect to be able to get there by crossing the Red Sea. You'd expect that if it was really, really significant, like, the most significant event in the history of Judaism, that there'd be, like, they would have written it down. They wrote it down on rocks. And when they're excited and they're doing their party, they wrote that down, too, on the rocks with the calf worship. And you'd expect to find the altar. You might expect, like, if you know you're doing well, to find Moses' altar, and you can find an altar there. So this all happens to be there. Anyway, you can draw your own conclusions, but I've drawn mine. So, but it shows, like, the stories of God are real, right? So, like, this guy Joel Richardson, who led the trip, he's one of the two people of the trip. And then they named Rhonda from Living Passage with the trip too. But he's like, what he wants to do is, he's got a scuba diving certification. He wants to go find an Egyptian chariot wheel at Nueva there, like, as a smoking gun for the world. He personally believes that this has been discovered and hidden from the Christian world or the modern world since 2019 because we're coming into an age where people don't believe anything. And so maybe people will believe if they see evidence, right? That's like, you know, what the creation scientist people go into as well. So it's real. Moses is also a prophet. So, right, Moses predicted Jesus. He said that another prophet would come in my name, right? And so, and all throughout the whole Old Testament, we see the prophecies. So Isaiah 53 is a good example. I have some parts of it here, right? He was despised and rejected from mankind. Isaiah is predicting a future person to help mankind. A man of suffering and familiar with pain. He was pierced because of our rebellion, crushed because of our iniquities, punishment for peace was brought upon him. So the same scriptures that talk about this amazing, incredible, impossible events of the 10 plagues and walking across the Red Sea and, you know, a mountain of fire and God shows up in real life. They also talk about a person that shows up in real life later named Jesus, right? And so the scriptures talk about Jesus, and there's also a whole bunch of evidence. If you want to get into it, right? I mean, like, right? You know, is he a liar, a lunatic, or a lord? You know, there's evidence that there's a bunch of people in around first century AD that weren't trained, but all of a sudden they're willing to die for a story, and they all died for it. None of them recanted the story; they all died for it. So it's really weird if it was a made-up story of a guy who didn't exist. But then it goes on to the future, like where we're at right now. So we're in 2024. We have war in Israel. We have interesting things happen in the Middle East. And we have a whole bunch of other stories in the Bible that talk about what's going to happen next. They talk about that Jesus is going to come back, that some guy's going to come flying across the sky in a storm cloud with lightning and like take over the world and magically save everybody, which seems like really out there, right? You know, like if something, the next thing that's a story, you might make up your own drugs or something. But like the story of the Exodus is a story that's really out there. Like, why would they walk across an ocean when they could have just ran the other way? But you see in the beachhead, there's nowhere else to go. And they got surrounded. So there's all sorts of other stories out there. Right? You see Revelation that says that in Psalm 68, it says, sing to God, O kingdoms of the earth. Sing praise to the Lord for him who rides on the ancient skies above. There's story and story over and over again in the Old Testament of God coming on, riding, being in the sky, on the clouds. So it's not just like a made-up story that the disciples thought of, like, oh, we're going to have God, Jesus in the air on a horse. But it says the seventh angel sounded his trumpet, and the kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord, his anointed one. He will reign forever and ever. So that's our hope, right? Our hope is that it's real. Like, he's really going to come. He's really going to come and make things right. But we know from the story of the mount, like, you can go out to the Exodus, like, it happens in a real world, right? Exodus happened in a real world. There's a real beachhead. They're really surrounded by mountains. The Egyptian army is really there. And they're able to get across. They visited a real mountain. They built real rocks for a real altar. They killed real cows. And all this stuff, you can walk through the book of Exodus and some of the numbers, and it's sitting there. It's real. So, like, Jesus will come for real. And, like, it's not going to be like a magical, like, you know, Peter Pan. But he's going to come. He's going to help. He's going to save a real people. He's going to save his people, Israel. So, more maps. So here's the area again, right? Here's Basra. There's some mountain trains around here called Paran. There's a mountain of Paran, Mount Sinai, Mount Paran. Seir was the land of ancient Edom and Jerusalem. I got about 10 minutes. So Ammon right now, this is the area. And the kingdoms of Ammon, Moab, and Edom were outside of Egypt. So there's real kingdoms, and they're referenced in the Bible. They were the relatives of the Israelites, right? Edom, Moab, and Ammon. So the Bible says over and over again how Jesus will return. He'll return in a real way. I mean, it's not going to be a magical fairy tale. He's going to come in a real way to a real people. His people are people of Israel. His people are the people of God, the people who hold the testimony like us. So I won't go through all of these, but there's a whole series of passages where it says the Lord comes from Sinai. He dawns over Seir and Paran. It says this over and over again, and I mentioned these are the mountain ranges. Here, Seir was the area of Edom. So he's coming from somewhere, from Sinai to the area. It says in Psalm 68, it says, he went before your people, O God. You marched to the wasteland, the desert. Your possession came into view, your possession of my God and King into his sanctuary. I wrote that wrong. Isaiah 63 is a very famous passage where Jesus comes and says, like, who is coming from Edom, from Basra, with his garment stained crimson? So Edom is right here. The capital of Edom has to be Basra. So Isaiah 63, who is coming? And it's a very messianic prophecy. Isaiah 63 is very much future. Like, who's going to come? He's taking out his enemies. He's bringing justice on the earth. It says it again in Habakkuk 3. But so there's a story throughout the Old Testament of God coming from the south up to the north. And it starts off with people think it's always describing the Exodus in Deuteronomy 33. But the way that the language works can be interpreted past, present, or future in the Hebrew. And you can see as it progresses through the Old Testament, all of a sudden you get some prophecies here that are obviously future. But it uses all the same language. Coming from Sinai, through Seir, through Paran, this northern trek, from the south to the north. So why does that matter? Okay, so we got 10 minutes, but I believe that this is one of the main reasons I went to Sinai, is I believe that the Bible describes the coming return of Jesus in context of the geography of Mount Sinai and that area of the world. So in Matthew 24, Jesus is telling the disciples and the people of God, when the Antichrist comes and attacks Jerusalem, it's going to happen in the real life. We can believe it's going to happen in real life, just like we believe that Moses happened and the Sinai happened. So when that happens, and he sets the abomination in the temple, he's going to set up like a, I don't know what it's going to be, something bad, calling the abomination of desolation in the temple. When you see that happening, run. Run out of Jerusalem, right? Is it Jesus says, let those in Judea flee to the mountains or to the desert. Okay, in Revelation 12, there's a dragon. There's a story of the dragon and a woman in the sky. The woman gives birth to a child, a male child, who's going to rule the world with iron scepter. So that's Psalm 2. It's Jesus, right? The woman who gives birth to Jesus. The people of Israel give birth to Jesus. So the woman is Israel in this story. So in the story, the woman who is taken in the desert and protected for 3.5 years, and there's weird stuff that happens. Satan throws water at her, which represents, I believe, armies, and the earth somehow miraculously protects her. So there's an Antichrist character, the devil, who's the Antichrist is his papa, and Revelation 13 and 14 introduces him. He goes after Israel. And then right then at the end, we know it's Israel too, because it says that at the very end, it says, so he couldn't get her. He couldn't get the woman. She was protected in the desert. She was carried on wings of eagles, which is Exodus language. And she's in the desert for 3.5 years, same number of years as described in Daniel 7. And then it says, the dragon goes out to fight the rest of her seed, those who hold the testimony of Jesus. So the woman has two kind of families. Israel, and says the devil's going to go fight the rest of her seed, those who hold the testimony of Jesus. I mean, us, right? So like the people of the promise, the people of God. So we know that Jesus says to the Jews to flee Jerusalem, to the mountains. Revelation says that the woman's going to flee the Antichrist in the end and go to the wilderness for 3.5 years. Daniel 11 describes when the Antichrist comes, there'll be three countries that he won't conquer. They happen to be the same area that Jesus tells him to run to. Edom, Moab, and Ammon. Isaiah 16 talks to the people of Moab right here and the people of Arabia, and it says, protect the Jewish refugees who are going to come to you. In Isaiah 16, it's a Babylonian prophecy, but prophecy happens more than once. And it says, protect them like midnight and noon until a throne is established in the line of the house of David, who will rule in peace, which is obviously referring to the end, Jesus ruling from in the Messianic age. Finally, in Matthew 25, Jesus says, he's splitting the sheep and the goats. It's the end of this huge section on the end times, Matthew 24 and 25. The last parable, and he says, the sheep go take their inheritance for those who cared for the sick and the poor and the needy and the naked and those in prison, the prisoners. And he said, for those who did those things for the least of these brothers of mine. So the brothers of Jesus are either, you know, the Jews or the Christians, right? These are the brothers of Jesus, according to other places in the New Testament. And then he goes on to say, if you don't take care of the weak and the naked and the hungry and the thirsty and those who have been taken captive, think refugees here, then you'll actually go to condemnation, which is really weird, right? Because all throughout the New Testament, like there's nothing else in the New Testament that says if you don't take care of the poor, you're going to go to hell. But it always says if you believe in Jesus, you go to heaven. If you don't believe, you go to hell. So there's something in the very end of the time where believing in Jesus will be so closely linked to taking care of Jesus' brothers that he'll actually equate it with going to hell. I believe that's a future refugee crisis of Israel. So Jesus tells them to flee. Their Revelation says they flee to the desert for 3.5 years, which matches the final tribulation described in Daniel. And then Satan goes off to fight everybody else, like the diaspora Jews and the Christians, because he miraculously somehow couldn't get the refugees who ran out of Jerusalem. We don't know why. It says the earth swallowed up the water. We don't know what that means. Somehow, like they're protected, right, against the armies. In Daniel 11, it says somehow, even though the Antichrist came from all around, even from like Yemen and Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Turkey, Iraq, somehow for whatever reason, modern-day Jordan is not conquered by him. Can't describe it. It's weird. It fits exactly like Revelation 12, where there's a place in the wilderness prepared for refugees. Isaiah 16 is specifically talking to Moab and Arabia, and it says, protect my refugees until a throne is established in peace. So he's telling them, and then the rest of Isaiah 16 says, you didn't do a very good job, and so I'm going to judge you. So only a remnant of even the people in that area will protect the refugees. I think when I hear this, I think of the Holocaust, like being a shelter of, like midnight and noonday. The story of the Holocaust resonates in my head, like, you know, hiding the Jews, Corrie ten Boom, you know, Anne Frank. There are people, you know, in Nazi Germany and in Poland and France and Netherlands. I think, you know, Anne Frank was in Netherlands. They hid the Jews at risk of their own life, right? They were a shelter at midnight and noonday. And now, in the future, the people of Moab, a.k.a. Jordan, and a.k.a. Saudi Arabia, are asked to do the same thing. So this is, we got 5 minutes. I'm happy to ask questions. And if you want a copy of these videos in the book, Sinai to Zion, which describes, there's a book that describes this entire theology in a book that's this thick. It took me a long time to read. So, written by Joel Richardson. So inclusion, like Sinai was real. Jesus was real. Like, there's all sorts of evidence for Jesus, if you read Josh McDowell. And so we can believe then that the future prophecies about Jesus returning is real. Right? So like, it's all real. And Sinai is interesting because, like, he's revealed it now. It's out in the desert just sitting there. But it's been cordoned off by, you know, geopolitics and religious conflict. You know, the Muslims have been there. And they'll tell you, and they walk up the Bedouin, and like, oh, of course that's Mount Sinai. That's where Moses did this stuff. Like, they all know it. And then keep on grazing their sheep and goats. So his return will be real. And so if we believe his return will be real, and if we have these scriptures that say it's going to happen in a real tangible way, like what I believe, like, you know, Jacob's trouble in Jeremiah 30 through 33 and other places, like, and the curse of the covenant, like, there's going to be a refugee crisis. Jesus said it's going to happen. He's going to flee Jerusalem. The Antichrist is going to come. There's going to be a certain area of the world that's protected. And then God says in Matthew 25, if you protect the brothers of mine, you go to heaven. If you don't protect the brothers of mine, you go to hell. Like, because as they're so linked between trusting and believing in God's story, believing the story of Jesus, believing the story of his whole story of coming to Israel. That's a big reason I went. It's like, what do I do with that? So I don't know. I have some ideas. I had some good conversations over there. What do you do with that? I'd be happy to talk to people offline about that. But like, that's the big question I'm having. Like, what do we do with all this knowledge we have? You know, we believe Jesus is coming back. You know, I think, like Sean would say, like, you know, we tell people about Jesus right here in Sioux City. We're also living in a global world, right? Like, I was able to fly to Mount Sinai eventually. And I barely got back. But like, what do we do with this? Like, if we know where the refugee crisis is going to happen ahead of time, we know where Jesus is going to come back as a conquering hero, like, and it says to take care of him. What do you do with that? So I'm ending with a question because I don't really know the answer. But I know that God has called us to do things, right? It says in Acts 1:5, you know, to go be a witness in Judea and Samaria throughout the ends of the earth. These are references. If you're interested, I can bring some of these and lend them to you or give them to you. Sinai to Zion is the book that describes the whole theology I just went through, or half of it. Patterns of Evidence Films. There's an app called the FAI app where you go through a whole bunch of studies on Daniel Revelation. And then some of the presentation came from these people, Rhonda and Dan and Doubting Thomas Research, so thanks to them. But yeah, we're out of time for community needs, but...